to Political Commentary. Today we welcome Neil Jones and Liam Hare. Kia ora korua.
Kia ora.
Good morning.
Neil was Chief of Staff to Labour leader Jacinda Ardern. Prior to that, Chief of Staff to the then leader Andrew Little, is now Director of Public Affairs firm Capital. Liam Hare is a Palmerston North lawyer, political commentator and National Party member. Let's start with Labour and the debate that is underway over its wealth tax, its capital income tax, whatever kind of tax that is being debated. And obviously the moment was always going to come, Neil, when in opposition party activists, the party grassroots, got to grips with this. What is actually happening?
So, given we're past an election now, the party starts a manifesto development process, and that means ideas get debated within the party, remits go up to party conferences and they get voted on, and eventually some of those ideas become policy. And so right now there's a bit of debate internally around tax, around wealth taxes or capital gains taxes, or something apparently called a capital income tax. I think it's fair to say there's good reason why Labour wants to look at this. There is an imbalance in our tax system between people who earn their money from capital, from investments, and people who earn it from, you know, cleaning toilets, teaching kids, you know, doing office jobs. And so that's a discussion that needs to be had. I do think some in the party are a lot more excited about wealth taxes than the general public are, and probably a lot more excited than the voters Labour needs to win. And usually in my experience, when these debates take place in public, sort of half-formed and speculative, that's not the best way to either sell an idea or win an election. So
you can't have a debate in private. I mean, this is what annoys me. You mentioned party conferences. We used to have fabulous, crazy propositions being put on the floor of party conferences and great debates, and it was lively and it was colourful. Everything's so shut down now behind closed doors. How can you do this behind closed doors?
Well, I think you can have, you know, at this stage where we're debating remits, I think it's useful to have meetings, people have discussions. Eventually you'll go up to conference and there'll be proposals up at conference, but I just think the more we have people speculating about it in the media or saying Labour might do this or might do that, look, I'd love it to be that we could have these discussions openly as
they
a country.
Have this discussion. This was one of the key issues when Chris Hipkins took over as leader, and we found out after the fact, canned his finance minister's proposals for tax reform. This became a key moment as to whether that was a big demographic loss for Labour with a certain party demographic to the Greens.
I think there's probably a portion of the vote that voted Green that might have stayed with Labour had they come out with the wealth tax. None of the research or evidence I've seen or heard of suggests wealth tax is what lost Labour the election. Labour lost the election because there was a cost of living crisis, they had ministers disgracing themselves, and there was just a series of economic challenges got on top of them. But regardless,
the revered former finance minister Michael Cullen, now revered within the party, said, "We simply do not pay enough tax for the level of services
we want. And so what you're hearing from me is not an argument that Labour shouldn't progress some kind of capital gains tax. I think where the caution from some comes from is that this is an issue which is very hard. Labour has disgraced itself and dismembered itself over this in 2011, 2014, 2017, 2023. It'd be quite easy to see 2026 being added to that list. So there's a hundred ways this could go wrong for Labour. And so I think for them to successfully sell a tax on capital, they need to be very clear, this is the problem we're trying to solve, this is who it will apply to, this is what it will raise, and critically, this is what we're spending it on. Because if you don't talk about the actual important thing is what's it going to allow you to do, you fall into all the worst traps.
Okay.
The right love it. They say this is just tax and spend Labour, who've wasted all the money and now they want more.
Yeah. Now, a post shared, this is an RNZ report, a post shared by one of Labour's social media accounts outlined former Revenue Minister David Parker's version of a capital income tax, which would target big earners whose incomes were not effectively captured by the present tax system. Remember, we had those screaming headlines about how little the very wealthy is paid. Liam, how are you coming at this?
Oh, look, I think you're being a bit harsh on Neil, to be honest. I'm going to inject some bipartisan, much needed bipartisan consensus here.
Might be the only stuff we get on that.
Yeah,
decision.
I know. Look, wealth taxes, capital income taxes, all that type of stuff is very exciting to enthusiasts, be they in politics or in the media, and nobody else in terms of that key demographic that you need to win an election. Now, you might point to polling that shows that there are people who support higher taxes or more new taxes, that type of thing. But no, those aren't necessarily the key people that swing the election, because the people who are most affected or most interested in that are quite often swing voters. Look, a point I would make is I want to echo what Neil said. Here we go again. You know, we've heard this story before. And the last time that a capital gains tax was attempted, the revered former finance minister Michael Cullen said it was the very last chance to have that tax, to have that a tax of that nature implemented. How many final chances do we need? The other point I just want to make is that, you know, in theory, it's really nice, the idea that you have political parties being this mass organisation, which are sort of the end room of ideas. But I think that's gone out the window just through the hollowing out of civil society. Political parties aren't mass organisations like they used to be. The average age is probably 70 in the National Party, and probably not too far off in the Labour Party. People don't join political parties as a normal course of events, and therefore the types of policy remits you're going to get from political parties aren't necessarily going to be the type of thing that have mass appeal. It's interesting that David Parker is making the running on all of this again. David Parker is a tax enthusiast. He damaged Chris Hipkins badly last year when he resigned on a point of principle as revenue minister, which is a pretty big thing. I mean, tax is the major policy a political party has to have. For him to damage Hipkins like that while remaining in cabinet, not resigning his other warrants, and then subsequently to be making the running on this when he's not even the finance spokesman or the revenue spokesman is pretty bad. And, you know, I think either it speaks to Chris Hipkins not being in the strongest position or him being distracted or something going on that he's not getting on top of David Parker and making David Parker stop, because it's going to be a distraction. It's going to hurt Labour. It's going to cause another round of speculation where a wedge is driven between its activist base and the voters it needs to win.
Back to the leader, Chris Hipkins, and back to your fair point that the caucus ultimately will end up likely determining this policy. When and how should they sort it once and for all, Liam?
Well, I thought it has been sorted. I thought this was the last chance. You know, how many times does something have to be ruled out? To be, you know, look, I guess obviously as long as the door is left open, as long as there's a crack in the door, it's never going to be sorted, it's never going to be sorted.
Can I make a couple of points? One of them is, again, I'm not saying Labour shouldn't have a discussion about this or do anything on it. I just think it needs to be done carefully, and I'm not seeing any evidence of that. The second thing I would say, which I think is a broader point, is former party president Nigel Harwer, someone I've worked with closely before, have a lot of respect for, he had a rather ill-advised interview in the Herald yesterday, I thought, around this, where he did make one good point, which was he said this has become, sort of taxes on wealth have become kind of symbolic or emblematic of a broader discussion in the party around the need to push back on the failed neoliberal experiment of the last 40 years. And I actually think that's a point. Is one of my concerns, I think this debate around wealth tax has kind of become a bit of a fixation for some, whereas actually we live in an era of economic populism. We're seeing that in the US right now. We're seeing that even from the current government with Shane Jones on energy or Nicola Willis on banks. And people are seeing that the last 40 years of neoliberal economics has not worked, has not delivered. And Labour does have an opportunity to say, hang on, what are we going to do differently? What's our bold alternative to the current system? And we're not seeing that debate. We're seeing a fixation on tax policy, on a very minor part of tax policy, when actually there's a far bigger economic discussion the party needs to have.
Yeah. The problem with a party's having discussions about things is that it is poisonous to the public. Because while the party's saying, well, we're not saying yes, we're not saying no, it comes across as being very vague and uncertain, and yet your opponents are able to paint the worst possible picture about what you're intending.
It's also depressing, sorry. It all plays into why people are so frustrated and switched off politics, this stuff. You know, acting on principle, having grassroots debates about things without being required to have a determined position, letting people have their say. It's
depressing, but it's the reality we work in. I mean, I personally would love to be able to have big, open, public debates about everything, but the reality is we live in a political and media environment where that just gets you whacked. And that's the rules of the game. And I don't like the game. We don't have to like the game, but that is the way it works.
No, okay. But those discussions can still happen at a think tank level. So David Parker needs to determine, does he want to be a member of the government in waiting, or does he want to be a think tank policy guy? And those things are not compatible anymore.
It seems to me also that this may well end up being a tussle between Labor and the Greens for a vote, rather than, to your point, Liam, the sort of mythical swing voter, the median voter, who does tend to determine elections. Let's have a look at some other matters that came up last week. Let's move on. A couple of matters that came up last week that are related. One was the announcement of a new infrastructure agency and some sort of an olive branch with a few leaves on it, according to some commentary I've seen, between National and Labor with respect to trying to get some kind of bipartisan conversation going on. And then also you had the New Zealand First member of the coalition really going at the Labor leader, Chris Hipkins, over saying essentially we're not going to guarantee consents granted under the fast-track consenting regime if we become the government. I put that to the Minister, Neil, that, you know, typically governments do not bind future parliaments and future governments. What do you make of some of the tension around these two areas last week? Again, was a lot of this just politicking?
Look, I think typically governments don't bind future governments, but when it comes to things like consents and contracts, generally speaking, there needs to be a pretty high bar to go back on those. I would think for most things that would likely come up in the fast-track consenting law, that's, you know, I think they'll be pretty uncontroversial. I think if you have an outrageous example, you know, if Shane Jones opens a coal mine in a national park or something, by all means, that might be something a future Labour...
On Schedule 4 land in national
park. Labour / Green government might have a look at, but... You know,
there's a principle of retrospectivity too, isn't it? Which is that, by and large, parliaments shouldn't change laws, and presumably the principal governments shouldn't undo what has been done, particularly, as you say, in the private sphere. Is that
I think critically it's about investor confidence, which is about saying if you look like you're going to tear up what people, you know, what a previous government had said you could do, that then makes future investors say, I'm not sure I'm going to make that investment because I can't trust the government not to change the rules. So that's why there's got to be a reasonably high bar for that kind of thing.
Was there a trap set for Chris Hipkins, Liam?
Oh, look, again, it's opposition mode, right? It's not the first time that opposition parties have said that they will, tear up or that people can't rely on rules made by the current government because when they come in, they'll change them. And, you know, as opposition approaches government, the cost to invest the confidence or the investment environment becomes more focused, and you actually see opposition parties starting to be a bit more reasonable. But I just want to really emphasise that there's a complete difference between binding a future parliament, which would be to entrench a rule so that a rule can't be changed going forward, and tearing up a permission or a consent or a right or a contract that's already been granted. Law changes need to be prospective, not retrospective. So it's all very well and good for Labor to come and say, we'll get rid of the fast track bill, and so there'll be no more fast track applications received, or even that all current fast track applications will be discontinued and won't be considered. But where an application has been granted and consent has been given, it would be a serious thing to tear that up. And that would rightly make New Zealand a bit of a pariah in terms of international investment and domestic investment.
All right. What about the infrastructure agency? Was there anything particularly to see here?
I thought
it's going to make a... Go on, Neil.
I was going to say, I thought the ambition for a 30-year infrastructure pipeline was... a very welcome idea, but I think totally impractical for the reason that, you know, you talk to anyone in industry and they'll tell you that we need more certainty of infrastructure and, you know, in order to have investment and in order for workforce, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is infrastructure investment is not a technocratic decision. It is a deeply political decision. Every party will have its own views of what a priority is. Every party wants the other side to agree to their priorities for the next 30 years. But unless you can get Julianne Jenter and Simeon Brown to agree on an infrastructure pipeline, it's probably not going to work. I think as well, the reality is if a six-monthly briefing of parties, which is what Chris Bishop has suggested is going to be his way to keep everyone on board, that's not sufficient. You'd need to have a cross-party group agreeing to everything. And even then, the only way it ever works long-term is if the cost of breaking that accord is higher than the gain from breaking it. And if you're in a negotiation to become government and a party holding the balance of power says, cancel that road, build that railway, you're probably going to do that if it's the price of power.
Liam, you lost me when you referenced that fabulous Aussie TV series Utopia and the nation-building yeah, authority. Is there the possibility something slightly less cynical could come out of this?
No, not with MMP. Like, again, I'm sorry to do this, but there needs to be more contention in these things, but I think Neil's right. You know, I mean, and Simon Wilson put it well in the interview before. He's, you know, the fact of the matter is that infrastructure decisions aren't purely technocratic. They don't stack up entirely economically. There are other factors at play, including ideological, including social factors. And so, you know, especially under MMP, where you will have more ideological parties joining coalitions, the reality is that you are not going to have a bipartisan consensus on a whole lot of things. And therefore, when people are talking about bipartisanship, they mean you need to be bipartisan by agreeing with me. And that's not true bipartisanship. I think Labour and National could come up together with an accord on at least some things, but in the MMP environment, where they're always going to rely on more populist parties on left and right and centre, it's just impossible. It's a nice idea.
Even when you come to just Labour and National, we have a real life example not that long ago, which is that Judith Collins as leader and Nicola Willis as the housing spokesperson for National stood up with the previous Labour government and agreed to a housing accord, bipartisan, was going to stand the test of time. I think it was about a year later, National unilaterally pulled out of it when the politics shifted. So, you know, this is the reality.
The ACT Party is a big driver in that, because the ACT Party, while it claims to be libertarian, is very strongly in favour of the rights of Auckland Grammar Zone parents and things like that. And so that, I think I would claim that as an example, at least partially, of the dynamic that I think exists. But look, here's the lesson. The lesson of the last sort of 30 years has been, if you want to bake in infrastructure, if you want to make sure that it happens, you need to actually get started. You need to get the project underway.
Make it too expensive to stop. Indeed. Yeah. Now, Shane Jones last week, I can't remember whether it was the Venezuelan government decision-making of Hipkins, were he to cancel the... To cancel any consents that have been granted under Fast Track, or calling a judge a communist in the context of the judge doing her job. Neil, first, are there breaches of the Cabinet Manual happening here? And if so, will anyone do anything about it?
I had a quick look at the Cabinet Manual before coming on air, just to refresh my memory. Arguably, there's a breach, certainly a breach in spirit. Will it hurt Shane Jones? No, he's a populist. Calling a judge a communist is not going to hurt him. Is it going to hurt him in terms of Christopher Luxon? No, Luxon's shown that he will never discipline New Zealand First or ACT MPs, ministers. So I don't think there's any harm. I don't think for the opposition, you know, restore comity between Parliament and the courts. I don't think that's a winning election tag. So I think, you know, yes, it's a breach. Is it good? Probably not. Will it hurt Shane Jones? No. I think as well it's worth noting that the context in which it came out, to be fair to Shane, you know, this was a comment in a private meeting. Notes were taken by an official, and those notes somehow became public.
Yeah, but then you resile from it at least. You quasi apologise at least. Look, you don't double down.
I'm not saying it's great. I'm just saying
right.
there's some mitigating factors.
Liam, you're a lawyer. For goodness sake, step up for the separation of powers and the inability of judges to speak for themselves and the undermining of institutions.
I will. So what Luxon should have said, I think, is that he had reminded Shane Jones that all ministerial actions, whether they occur in a hotel room or a private meeting, have the risk of becoming public knowledge, and that, you know, you need to comport yourself accordingly. And, you know, instead what the Prime Minister's office did was to say, well, it's just descriptive because this judge was a communist in the 70s and the 80s, which is a...
It's just too,
you know,
cute, isn't it?
It's a real cop-out. It's just ridiculous.
And I think if there is politics in this, actually, it's for the opposition. It's in pointing out that where there is a breach like this, the Prime Minister should be maintaining standards and seems unable to.
Yeah, so we are in an era, I think, where we're actually going to see increased tension between the courts and the executive and the legislature, because the courts have crossed the threshold a little bit where they're quite willing to get involved in political questions, you know, from things like the vote, from the voting age to climate change to the to sort of rewriting the foreshore, the marine title law. And so you might think, well, the legislature and the executive have the right to defend themselves, and they do. But when you have that tension, it's even more important to have that decorum, right? Because when you're going into a confrontation with the courts, or you're going to criticize the courts, it's even more important to be above board in the way you do it. Now, Christopher Luxon has shown that he has prioritized comity between the branches of the coalition rather than the branches of the government.
Okay.
And that is probably politically wise, but it's constitutionally wrong.
Now, Darlene Tanner, goodness me, speaking of legal actions, when is this saga going to end? Are the Greens going to give it up in the end, do you think, Neil?
I don't think they should. In my experience in politics, when someone shows themselves to be disloyal and destructive, you need to put an end to them very quickly. If you try and delay or compromise, it ends up biting you down the track. Chloe Swarbrick, I think, has handled this very well.
This is the injunction we should remind listeners, the injunction that Darlene Tanner brought that caused the Greens to pause or stop the meeting that was to consider whether they would progress with party hopping.
I think they should push on. Chloe Swarbrick has shown she's willing to use the wicker jumping bill, I think. There will be inevitable claims of hypocrisy. I think she's done well enough to sort of explain the reasons the Greens opposed wicker jumping legislation initially, but how this case does not fit those, which is that Darlene Tanner essentially has no constituency, has been in Parliament for 5 minutes, and has basically represents no one and seems entirely in it for herself. So I think drive her out, she'll lose any platform and get on with things.
Liam?
Oh, I think that's a very heroic defence, Neil, of the Greens. I mean, look, you could say that about any MP who's been subject to wicker jumping laws or who have inspired wicker jumping laws. What was Alamein Kupu's a constituency or power base?
Oh, none. She was another poster child of the wicker jumping law. But there's a big difference.
And yet the Greens opposed that, right? Yeah. The Greens were adamantly, in principle, opposed to that to that law then, for that example.
How old Chloe Swarbrick was then, but
no,
not
she's
very.
Don't know if she's even born.
You cannot say that you're being consistent when you go from saying you're against the law, but you're voting for it in 2018, come out in favour of voting against it to repeal it in 2020, and then saying
like consistency and principle in politics, Liam.
Look, I agree that there is an element of hypocrisy, but I think, you know, Chloe Swarbrick has to use it. I think she's done well, you know, she's done a pretty good job of defending the rationale for it. But look, I'm a supporter of the wicker jumping legislation. I think it makes sense, and I think this is exactly why it should exist.
Fun fact, I don't think you're allowed to call someone a hypocrite in Parliament. I think it's unparliamentary. So
yes.
I just said the case against the Greens is totally without merit. It's ridiculous. I mean, how can there be a judicial review of the Green Party, a process of the Green Party? The Green Party is a political party. It's not a part of the state, you know. So despite whatever claims of hypocrisy there are, the case against them is completely without merit.
Thank you both, Liam Hare and Neil Jones.